Hello and welcome to the First Impressions podcast. My name's Chris John Riley, and together with my co-host Martin McKay, we'll be talking to presenters at the upcoming FIRST conference taking place in Denver, Colorado between June 14th and 19th, 2026. We look forward to seeing you at the conference, and now we join our interview in progress.
Good morning, and we are here at the second day of the FIRST conference in Denver, Colorado, and I am talking to Chris Patera, who is the Acting Executive Assistant Director of Cybersecurity for CISA. How are you doing today, Chris?
Fantastic. Thanks for having me, Martin.
Now, okay, so let's talk a little bit about CISA first, so I know that I'm actually understanding what is the role of CISA in U.S. government?
So CISA is America's cyber defense agency, and our mission is to defend and protect both the federal civilian executive branch government agencies, as well as state, local, and tribal and territorial governments, and U.S. critical infrastructure.
And as a large part, or not a large part, but as part of that, one of the things that your organization and you and specifically are responsible for is the CVE program. Talk about how that's changed, what's going on right now in CVE. What's some of the latest news?
Yeah, the CVE program is a very important program for us. It's a global common good that we help to operate and maintain. The CVE program is really that authoritative source of vulnerabilities for all technology products. And we've really grown this program over the last decade or so. You know, about 10 years ago, we only had about 26 CVE numbering authorities. And we've expanded that federation to over 500 CVE numbering authorities. And we continue to recruit both government CSERTs as well as product security teams to be their own CVE numbering authorities as well.
And that means that they can identify and give it an official number so that it's recorded and basically for posterity's sake.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way that we actually uniquely identify a specific vulnerability so that you can tie, you know, look for it in threat activity, you know what to patch, and it's used by, you know, the entire cybersecurity ecosystem at large. It also underpins a lot of our operations as well, so it's really useful for us to continue to invest in that program and to continue to build it out. And, you know, I think with what we've seen, especially in the technology landscape shift, the number of CVE records has grown exponentially as well.
Yeah.
So we recorded, we published 48,000 records last year, and we are well on pace to break that this year.
I can remember when that would be hundreds in a year, but that was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Are you on... Maybe I shouldn't ask this, but do you think you're going to break that number this year?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, that's not a good thing necessarily.
I mean, I think volume of CVEs isn't always a bad thing. It does show that some of those product security teams have a certain level of maturity. And so I think we try to always make sure people understand that volume of CVEs alone is not representative of a product's being a bad product, but rather usually it's a mature PCERT team.
It's also a function of who's paying attention to it.
Yeah.
I mean, because some no-name piece of software nobody's ever heard of might have five CVEs, but Microsoft Office is going to have a few more because there's a few more people looking at it.
That's true as well.
So, but that brings us into a kind of an important question of supply chain compromise, because with that, a lot of what we've been seeing, a lot of the warnings you've been giving as an organization are warning us about supply chain compromise. We're seeing it right now in the news. How do the two fit together, and what does that allow us to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the entire vulnerability ecosystem is really important here. So in the supply chain world, one of the things that we've been trying to work on for a long time is the software bill of materials. So we continue to work with our partners on publishing minimum elements and best practice guidance on how to publish software bill of materials so that, you know, if there is a supply chain compromise, you can try to quickly understand if your product has that version of the compromised product and you could be affected.
And that's becoming more and more important as we're seeing actual compromises of that supply chain in the wild. It's not, I remember when I got into security, it was a thought experiment, not a reality. And for the last 10 years, it's been our reality.
Yeah.
Maybe more.
Yeah, we've seen a lot, especially in some of the open source software where we've had different package managers have supply chain compromises, and that quickly gets distributed out throughout, you know, the package management ecosystem, or even just people manually downloading some of these packages. So we think it's really important to make sure that we are registering CVEs for the compromised packages, as well as people are publishing that software bill of materials, which is really that ingredients list of what's in your software.
And that's still something that's maturing. I mean, I can remember when that first came on the scene, it was, oh, that's a wonderful idea, it'll never happen, and now it's actually happening. I find that incredibly, how to put it, it makes me hopeful for security in a lot of ways. And another thing that you're working on is the G7, let me make sure I get this right, the G7 SBOM for AI minimum elements. Now, that to me is something we really need right now. Explain to me how that came about and what it is you hope to accomplish with that.
Yeah, so what it really does is it builds upon our software bill of materials minimum elements work and takes a look at what are the AI-specific minimum elements that we should be adding to any kind of SBOM for AI systems. And we do this because we really believe that AI systems are software systems to begin with, right? So we should include all those software bill of materials minimum elements as a starting point. And then what this product did was it outlined the additional elements that we believe should be added to any AI system SBOM.
Can you give me some examples of what should be in an AI SBOM? Because with a software bill of materials for other products, you really have these lines of code lead to that. Mm-hmm. With AI, it's not that clear, is it?
Yeah, I mean, there's things like model information and versions, right, that is going to be a little bit different than a normal software bill of materials, which might have things like, the components of the software that are building the bigger piece of software, right? So the AI one just has more of the AI-specific components of an AI system.
Yeah, I guess that's all we are going to be able to hope for at this point. I think that at some point it's going to have to get a lot deeper into that. But then I guess that's going to be when we're having AIs auditing AIs, because you and I are just not going to cut it.
Well, and I think that's what we're trying to do, is add as much automation into this ecosystem and make it as machine readable as possible, so that we can take less human effort to do these types of supply chain evaluations and things like that. We also have a few other initiatives I'd love to mention about some of the automation in the vulnerability ecosystem.
Let's hear about
it. Like building on CVE, building on SBOM. We are also working with product vendors to start publishing their end of support timelines for software using OpenEOX. And what that does is it publishes a machine readable version of all the company's products and the versions and when those products are going end of support.
Okay.
And then we're trying to use that data to make sure that we're getting those end of support software and hardware, especially mm-hmm. off the edge and off the internet, but also making sure that it gets into that broader vulnerability ecosystem. So in addition to when you're scanning for vulnerabilities, you're also understanding when you have products that will no longer have CVEs because they're going end of support and they won't be fixed.
Which we all know is a problem, because so many of organizations still have, beyond end of life cycle, networking and other equipment out there, mostly because they don't think they know about it, even when they are doing all the scanning.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. People have trouble with their inventories, especially things like the edge, where they're not necessarily paying attention to the edge most of the time. And I think there's also the other side of the coin, when it's not broke and it's just working, people tend to just let it go, right? And so we are really concerned, especially about those network devices on the edge.
Now, one other topic that maybe is a little bit more sensitive, but is the fact that CISA is a government organization. Security as a whole is always looking for more people because we don't have enough. CISA, how are you handling all of that? Because I've known a number of people who've come to CISA, known a number of people who've left. It's not an easy job, especially at your level. And we need more people there. How is that affecting you?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we are always trying to bring good, talented, technical people into the organization. I also say we have a fantastic workforce now that is continuing to deliver on mission every single day. But we do have a hiring sprint right now, and our acting director has told us that he expects to have 180 temporary job offers issued in the next month. So that's a lot of new folks coming in the door. But for us, it's always, the harmony between people coming in and out of industry and in and out of government is a really a good mix for us, because they have that industry experience, they can bring that to government, And then when they go back out, they understand kind of how government works and makes it easier for us to work with industry as well.
Plus, they can take your message out there and deliver it to others, even if they're not still working with you.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or not still working for you, because obviously they will still be working with you.
They tend to be our best ambassadors, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris, is there anything I haven't asked you about that you should tell the world?
I think I'm great. Oh. Thank you for having me today.
And it's been great to have you, and get out there and fight the good fight.
Have a great week at first.
You've been listening to the First Impressions podcast, the official podcast of the First Conference. The upcoming First Conference is taking place in Denver, Colorado, between June 14th and 19th. Looking forward to seeing you there.